ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there. My name's Matt Brand. Welcome to the program. Cotton crops getting chewed on in the Douglas Daly region. Today you'll hear which insects agronomists and farmers are keeping an eye on.
One of the insects that we find is the cotton stainer, which pierces the bolls. There's a second insect, very similar, which is also doing similar damage, and we're now doing some trials to work out whether that is causing economic damage.
Also today, a look at the importance of biocrusts and how to protect them on your property. And before 1:30, you will get to meet the bloke who paddled down a river this week in a giant pumpkin.
The night before, I was moderately concerned it wasn't going to float. Once I actually got out in the river, I knew it was a floaty thing. So, yeah, it was just a matter of controlling it and just, yeah, thinking ahead and planning where I was going to be on the river.
It was a floaty thing, this 400-kilo pumpkin. All these stories and plenty more coming up on today's Country Hour. Hope you can stick around. We're broadcasting across the territory on the ABC. And g'day to those who have downloaded the podcast. It has been a big couple of days for the Senate inquiry into supermarket prices, with Bunnings, Coles and Woolworths all copping a grilling there in Canberra. There were plenty of fiery moments, including this one from Green Senator Nick McKim.
You're here before a Senate committee today. We're not interested in PR spin. We're not interested in you kind of bullshitting your way through this committee. We are interested in you answering the questions.
Now, on the Country Hour yesterday, I put to you the question, do you think this inquiry will achieve anything? And I've got to say, all of the text messages that we got essentially said no, this inquiry will achieve nothing, naught, zip, nothing. What does the National Farmers Federation think? The chair of the NFF's Horticulture Council is Jolyon Burnett. I spoke to him earlier on and started by asking what he felt we'd actually learnt about the major supermarkets and Bunnings over the last couple of days.
I think we've learnt that the consumers and the suppliers' concerns are well-founded. I think to see representatives of the three big boxes duck and weave and evade really has confirmed in everyone's mind that they're participating in behaviour towards their suppliers and their customers that they're not particularly proud of.
Do you think this inquiry will actually achieve anything and lead to anything meaningful?
It is something that certainly concerns the members of the Horticulture Council. This wouldn't be the first public inquiry where there's been a lot of sound and fury, but it's ended up signifying very little. So we are concerned. But look, I think it's worth saying that the level of public scrutiny on the big boxes, on the supermarkets, I think there are six separate inquiries of various kinds looking into this. And the interest the public has shown and the airing that it's got in the media, I think will mean that CEOs and their boards think a lot more carefully before participating in this sort of unconscionable behaviour and before, you know, they so blatantly attempt to price gouge. So I do think it will see a tempering of behaviour at the very least. Now, obviously, we hope for far more than that. We hope that...
Yeah, what would the National Farmers Federation ideally like to see?
Yeah, we'd like to see... There's a thing called the Food and Grocery Code, which is at the moment voluntary, but it sort of stipulates the sort of behaviour there should be between suppliers to these big supermarkets and Bunnings and those companies. At the moment, it's voluntary. We would like to see it made mandatory, and we were very pleased to see Dr. Emerson's interim report recommend that. We'd like to see the ACCC given much increased investigative powers to be able to demand information from the big supermarkets and Bunnings to be able to determine clearly whether they are price gouging, what sort of margins they are charging. You know, one of the hidden costs here is they may, at a headline level, pay growers market price for their produce. But then by the time the growers paid the rebate for promotion, the rebate for shelf space, the rebate for store improvements, the rebate for early payment, growers are often getting much less than the original contract price. So we'd like to see the ACCC have powers to expose those kinds of behaviours and the details of the contracts, not necessarily to the public. We understand commercial sensitivities, but at least so that they can be assured this sort of behaviour is not taking place. We'd like to see much increased penalties. And again, we were very pleased to see Dr. Emerson recommend in his interim report penalties of up to 10% of turnover. Now, you know, God forbid that those sorts of penalties ever need to be used, but it is really important that the regulators have those sorts of penalties that are commercially significant to companies of this size in their back pocket to try and to improve their behaviour.
So, just on the Food and Grocery Code of Conduct, I heard Bunnings argue that the code's sort of designed for supermarkets and is not fit for purpose for a retailer like Bunnings. What do you think?
Oh, look, we think it should undoubtedly be applied to Bunnings. We do accept that there may be some modifications, some alterations required. Yeah, I would accept Bunnings' point that there are some differences, but not sufficient to warrant not including them in the code. Their behaviour is so similar to the behaviour of Coles and Woolworths that it's very clear they need to be regulated under a similar framework.
And just finally, I think we've all learned a bit about return on equity in the last 24 hours or so. Do you think it's an accepted measure of a company's profitability?
Oh, look, absolutely. I mean, I acknowledge that Woolworths' board and their shareholders are entitled to use whatever measure of their profitability they see fit. However, they would be calculating their return on equity, and clearly Coles' ability to give that figure to the inquiry shows that the companies do measure that. And it's also a legitimate measure of profitability. And Woolworths' reluctance to divulge it, I think Senator McKim and the inquiry were right to be suspicious of that. You know, when their return on equity makes them more profitable than the most profitable banks in the world, while consumers and growers are having to tighten their belt, I think that really tells the whole story.
Thanks for your time today.
No problems, Matt. Thanks for your interest.
That is Julian Burnett, who's the chair of the NFF's Horticulture Council. Associate Professor Andrew Schmullo from the University of Wollongong, he gave evidence at the Senate inquiry yesterday into supermarket prices. And he was asked by Senator Nick McKim for his thoughts on all of those questions about Woolworths' return on equity. Let's have a listen to that exchange.
In your experience, is return on equity an accepted measure of assessment of a company's profitability?
Of course.
Thank you. What do you make of a CEO of a corporation earning or making over $1 billion of profit every year, the CEO earning $8 million plus in remuneration last year, not knowing the return on equity of his company last year?
Mr. Banducci is a very smart and very numerate man. He was a management consultant, and he has done a very good job in driving Woolworths' market share. There's only one reason why he doesn't like to talk about return on equity, because it doesn't suit the narrative. And the narrative is, oh, woe is us, our margins are so low, have some sympathy for us. But the fact that their margins are low doesn't mean there's something wrong with their business. The fact that their margins are low is because that's the business that they're in. They don't make anything, they don't manufacture anything, they don't mine anything out of the ground, they don't have a research and development budget. They're the physical version of eBay. All they do is sell stuff. And so under those environments, and typically across their competitors across the globe, margins are low and volumes are high. So they like to sell this narrative, and Ms. Weckert was doing it too. She was saying, you know, our margins are very low. Yeah, that's the business you're in. You're in a low margin, high volume business. So now we want to know, how profitable is that business? Because that's an indication to us as to whether your excessive market concentration is gouging consumers, which is the purpose of this inquiry. And of course, they don't want to go there.
That's Associate Professor Andrew Schmulo. There's more information about this inquiry up on the ABC Rural website. And of course, if you missed our coverage yesterday, you can find it all via the podcast.
Yo, my name's David Mariela Yunupingu. I work at the Ranger and culture advisor, taking all the kids, learning on country, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
Ooh, this is big news. The headquarters of Australia's chemical regulator, the APVMA, will stay in the country town of Armidale in New South Wales, despite a recommendation from an independent review that it be moved back to Canberra. The organisation was found last year to be captured by industry interests, was subject to regular complaints of misconduct, and had lost about 90% of its staff after it was forced to move to Armidale back in 2016 by the former Ag Minister Barnaby Joyce. A report by Ken Matthews released today recommended the APVMA be abolished as a separate authority and moved into the Department of Ag in Canberra. The Ag Minister Murray Watt said that recommendation will not be adopted.
So the report that I've released today does recommend that the APVMA be moved back to Canberra. And just to give you a bit of the history, you might recall a few years ago when Barnaby Joyce was the Agriculture Minister, he unilaterally moved the APVMA from Canberra to Armidale, just happened to be in his own electorate. The problem was that the APVMA lost about 90% of its staff at the time. It got so bad that at one point the staff were having to work out of the local McDonald's to get access to Wi-Fi. And that kind of chaos and disruption really set the organisation up for trouble. And that trouble arrived. There was some very serious allegations of workplace misconduct. There were allegations that the organisation had become too close to the industry that it's supposed to regulate. And that's why we've conducted these reviews to work out what to do from here. But my view was that even though the recommendation was that it should be moved back to Canberra, I think that it would just see exactly the same kind of chaos and disruption that we saw when Barnaby Joyce was the minister. And I don't think that's in anyone's interests. Under the new management that we've got in place at the APVMA, I think the organisation is rebuilding itself in a positive way. And I think the last thing we want to do is see another mass exodus of staff, the more disruption, which impacts on the organisation's performance as well in its ability to regulate chemicals and get approvals finalised.
And when it does come to staff and chemicals as well, there has been a lot of calls for assurance, really. Will the AUVPMA be able to get in enough staff to fill out everything that's required to get the chemicals farmers and grain growers need?
Yeah, I think that the balance we've struck here today is the right one to make sure that the APVMA can get the staff that it needs and can do its job properly, and importantly, be a really great place for people to work. Obviously, people are going to want to work in an organisation more if they're being treated respectfully, if there's a good workplace culture. One of the recommendations in the review that we have accepted is that we should repeal what's known as the Government Policy Order, or the GPO. That was also brought in at the time that Barnaby Joyce was the minister, which required staff at the APVMA to be based here in Armidale. The way things have turned out, there's about 40% of the staff here are not based in Armidale anyway. So in some ways, repealing that order and bringing the APVMA in line with every other agency in the federal government where they can choose where people are based on their skills, the right role, the right person, bringing it in line with the rest of the public service gives the APVMA the ability to choose the best people for the job in the right location. My expectation is that the majority of staff will remain in Armidale for a long time to come. And you might have heard me say in the press conference, you know, there's a 10-year lease on this building. There's some good relationships being formed with the University of New England. But from time to time, there are going to be particular skill sets needed that aren't necessarily available locally. And we want to make sure that the organisation can hire the best people for the role, whether they're based here, Canberra, or somewhere else. There's many federal government agencies where the CEO is based in one place when there's many other staff based elsewhere. It's a national organisation. But what I can say is that my expectation is that the new CEO will either be based in Arbordale or will spend a significant proportion of their time here.
That is the Federal Ag Minister Murray Watt speaking to Peter Sanders. The National Farmers Federation has welcomed this news. Its Chief Executive Tony Ma says it's imperative to the farm sector that the APVMA gets back on track. He says the NFF supports the Minister's decision against relocating the APVMA back to Canberra. Says reversing the decision would likely only cause further negative impacts for the organisation's ongoing services, performance and business. He says it's critical the APVMA manages long-term operational costs and risks to ensure that operating out of two offices in Armidale and Canberra does not impact the timely delivery of core services. It's a quarter to one. You are tuned into the Country Hour. Up next, a trip to the Douglas Daily region to check out some cotton crops and make sure they're not being chewed by insects. That is Tommy Curtin and the tune Why We Live Out Here. You are tuned into the Country Hour. We're just receiving news that the Queensland government has bought a cattle station. That's the go. We'll bring you details about that purchase in just a moment. But up next, let's go and check out some cotton in the Douglas Daily.
Yeah, g'day. It's Greg Owens here. Recently retired from NT Farmers, but still hoping to be a big part of our farming community in the north. And you're listening to the NT Country Hour.
Now, one of the keys to growing cotton successfully in northern Australia has been access to a variety of GM cotton called Bollgard 3, which is essentially designed to protect the cotton plant from being attacked by caterpillars. This variety has been a game changer for cotton in the north. At a cotton field day in the Douglas Daily yesterday, entomologist Dr. Brian Thistleton spoke about some other insects in the region that are getting onto cotton crops. And while they're not causing major problems, he says it is worth keeping an eye on them.
One of the insects that we find is the cotton stainer, which pierces the bolls. There's a second insect, very similar in coloration, called the false cotton stainer, which is also doing similar damage. And our entomologist here, based in Katherine, is now doing some trials to work out whether that is causing economic damage.
So what can the Bollgard cotton defend itself against new insect threats?
So it won't defend against things like I've just talked about, the cotton stainers, and there's a new weevil that we've found. Won't defend against those. The Bollgard cotton works specifically on Lepidoptera, so basically on caterpillars. But a new threat that came in a few years ago, in 2020, was the fall armyworm, which could attack cotton. It's a Spidoptera, like the Spidoptera latura, which we already have on cotton. But those genes, that Bollgard cotton, will be protected against that because of the inbuilt toxins from the bacteria.
Is there a new variety in the works that could defend against these new threats?
Not that I know of on the new threats. They're not looking at doing things with that. But so with the new threats, I mean, it's important with cotton insects that we use IPM techniques. There are quite a lot of beneficial insects that control things like aphids and other things out there. The important thing is in IPM you use a mixture of technologies. So you're using biocontrol, you're also using insecticides, but you have to choose insects. You have to monitor the crop and make sure you only spray when necessary. And when you do spray, you have to spray chemicals that are, if possible, selective, so they're not affecting your beneficial insects.
Could the mealybug be a threat to cotton?
There is a mealybug on cotton, the Selenopsis mealybug, which is not that common. The new mealybug that's in the territory is the papaya mealybug. That's an exotic that originally came from Central America and spread into Florida and then in Southeast Asia. It tends to favour frangipani and hibiscus and pawpaw. And although cotton is on a quite long host list it's got. Overseas, it doesn't seem to have been a big problem on things like cotton. As I say, it comes from Central America. The US Department of Agriculture found a whole suite of parasitoids. Now, parasitoids are tiny, tiny little wasps that breed inside the mealybug and kill it. And those wasps have been introduced to a number of countries in Southeast Asia and given really good control. And one of those wasps has come in with the mealybug, so we're hoping that that will now start to build up, and we're recording a build-up on our sticky boards and things. We're also using native ladybirds, Cryptolemus, which are already in the territory, but which can be increased in population by buying extra ones from biological control suppliers, which is what we're doing at present.
That is Principal Entomologist Dr. Brian Thistledon speaking to Jan Kahoot at a cotton field day in the Douglas Daly region. There's actually an interesting cotton trial happening in the Douglas Daly at the moment. It's Bolgard 3 being grown, but with a trait that allows a wider variety of herbicides to be used to kill weeds and hopefully improve cotton yields as well. You'll be hearing more about this in the coming days here on the Country Hour. Now, up next, this is breaking news. The Queensland government's gone and bought a cattle station near Longreach with plans to turn it into a national park. More on that next.
The May issue of Gardening Australia is filled with growing goodness. Feast your eyes on gorgeous new release roses. Read about growing proteas and Japanese zelkova. And take a fresh look at chrysanthemums. Visit an artist's garden, give your indoor plants a health check, learn how to maximise your veggie harvest, and get tips on easy ways to compost. Available from newsagents and abcmagazines.com.au.
Yeah, how about this? A cattle station near Longreach, about 300,000 hectares in size, has just been bought by the Queensland government and will be turned into a national park. The purchase of Vergemont Station was made with the help of an anonymous donation of $21 million, which has been called Australia's single largest donation for land conservation. As Madeline McCosker reports, this property has been labelled the gateway to the Lake Eyre Basin.
Home to the endangered night parrot and the vulnerable yellow-footed rock wallaby, the 300,000-hectare property boasts more regional ecosystems than any of the state's existing national parks. And now it belongs to the state government. The deal to buy Vergemont was made possible by an anonymous donation of $21 million brokered by the Nature Conservancy, a global environmental non-profit that was founded in the US in 1951, and it's dedicated to conserving land and water for nature. It's the third outback Queensland property bought by the state government this year and expands the protected area to more than 1.5 million hectares. Environment Minister Leanne Linnard takes me through the details.
One of the largest and most environmentally significant land acquisitions in recent history, something that we are really, really excited about. Vergemont Station sits at the headwaters of the Lake Eyre Basin, one of Queensland's most important inland river catchments and one of the last remaining free-flowing arid river systems in the world. So it really is of global significance.
One of the key concerns for locals and particularly neighbouring graziers is the land management and pest control. So what's the government's commitment to those properties in regards to, you know, pest control, land management, fencing, all the rest of it?
Well, pest management, of course, and invasive weeds and pests are a massive issue for us with our parks as well. They absolutely threaten the health and of our well-being. They threaten the health of the biodiversity and the importance of that biodiversity on our properties and on country. So we invest a very significant amount in managing that. We do so often in consultation and partnership with traditional owners, and of course have many of our rangers are Indigenous land and sea rangers as well. We have the same challenges that private property and landholders have. So managing that absolutely is a part of our everyday work. There is a good neighbour policy where the department will be engaging, and those land managers we will have on park will be consulting with surrounding neighbours. Part of the surveying of the property will be checking the existing condition of the fencing. with neighbours, and of course just touching base with them to see, well, where are the issues? I mean, the fencing might be in good condition, that's great, but ongoing management, some questions have been asked about perimeter baiting. These are all things that we have to do as well, so they will be part of the ongoing conversation and relationship that we'll have with these neighbours.
Queensland Environment Minister Leanne Lynard speaking to Madeline McCosker. The Queensland government's gone and bought Vergemont Cattle Station. Now, earlier in the program, you heard from the National Farmers Federation, which feels Bunnings should be included in the Food and Grocery Code of Conduct and for that code to be mandatory. I'm joined in the studio by Dan Fitzgerald. Dan, we've received a statement from Bunnings. What has it had to say about this?
Yeah, Bunnings' Managing Director Mike Schneider said, "We acknowledge this review and the interim report and note its assessment that the code has been designed specifically for the supermarket sector. We also note its assessment that extending it to other industries may create unintended consequences. The characteristics of the industry sector that Bunnings is a part of is both diverse and structurally different to many other sectors, including the pharmacy, supermarket and others. And because of this diversity, it will make it the application of such a code quite difficult to apply, particularly given our commercial offer and exposure to the building and construction industry." Bunnings says, "Like every organisation, we don't get it right every time, but we work incredibly hard to build long-standing win-win relationships with our suppliers."
Okay, thank you for that, Dan Fitzgerald. We've got to go to the newsroom because it is 1 o'clock. I'll see you back here in 5 minutes for a chat with the Weather Bureau.
I'm Emily Hoffman, and I love chasing chunky skinks in the top end. And you are listening to The Country Hour.
Matt Brand with you this afternoon. In a moment, a look at the importance of biocrusts and how to protect them on your property. And as promised, before 1:30, you will get to meet the bloke who paddled down a river this week in a giant pumpkin.
The night before, I was moderately concerned it wasn't going to float. Once I actually got out in the river, I knew it was a floaty thing. So, yeah, it was just a matter of controlling it and just, yeah, thinking ahead and planning where I was going to be on the river.
Why stop at just growing a giant pumpkin when you can hollow it out and paddle it down a river? Ah, it's the story of the week. Let's go to the Weather Bureau. Billy Lynch is there this afternoon. How are you, Billy?
Yeah, going good. Thanks, Matt.
That's the go. A little bit more rain up in the northeast of the territory?
Yeah, there is. So, you know, rainfall totals in our gauge is not huge, but up until 9 a.m, Gove Airport's had another, well, nearly 18 millimetres, generally less than 10 millimetres in our other gauges across the Arnhem District. It's only been the Arnhem District that we've picked up any rainfall. And then continuing today, yeah, so the radar's showing some scattered showers and a few storms on the Gove radar at the moment, and then a lot of activity offshore in the Arafura Sea as well.
Any chance for some moisture to drift into the north part of the Barkly or maybe further west?
Yeah, there sure is. So our satellite imagery is showing some scattered clouds over northwest Queensland and then extending up into the northeast Barkly and across the Carpentaria region and then into the top end. So it's not going to be a lot of rain in it, in the Barkly, but this afternoon there'll be some isolated showers, maybe a thunderstorm. So maybe not quite getting to Elliot, but perhaps around Creswell Downs and that sort of far northeast Barkly.
Okay. I'm just looking at the weekly rainfall bulletin, and Gove Airport's had 164 millimetres for the week, and Cape Wessel's had 220. They're decent totals for that part of the world. Can we talk about the tropical cyclone forecast?
Yeah, I would love to. So we've, I guess, increased the risk of a cyclone forming in our neck of the woods to a moderate risk for the weekend. So what we're expecting is we could get a low pressure system form over the next day or two. We're expecting that if it's going to form somewhere between the northeast Arnhem District and North Queensland. And then, yeah, look, if things are going well for it from a cyclone perspective. There is just a window over the weekend, Saturday, Sunday, where we could get a small tropical cyclone up in the Arafura Sea. So we're just trying to highlight that risk. So it's about a 25% risk that we've got, a moderate risk over the weekend.
Of it developing into a cyclone, what's the potential then it could cross the coast?
That would be possible. I guess the northeast Arnhem coast would be sort of most exposed to any cyclone that could form, as could the North Queensland coast as well, just depending on where it moves. So, just a timely reminder, it's still mid-April, we're still in the cyclone season, and we just need to just keep across the latest information and be aware that, you know, cyclones can form in the last couple of weeks of April.
And just finally, you've got the numbers for us, Billy. The wet season to date, so from the start of October to now, Darwin's had how much rain versus the average?
So Darwin has had 1,765 millimetres, and the average is just over 100 millimetres or less than that. So we're tracking above average by about 100 millimetres.
Okay. Thanks very much for your time, the Savo. Is there anything else that you feel we should be aware of?
No. I think, that's pretty much it for today.
No. Well, I guess the headline is that moderate chance of a cyclone. We'll keep an eye on that one. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
I'm Gibson Sisomu. I'm the program leader for sustainable agriculture within the SPC Land Resources Division, based in Fiji. And you're listening to The Country Hour.
Matt Brown with you this afternoon. A soil researcher and farmer says they'd like to see an advertising campaign telling people about the importance of biocrusts and why you should avoid driving on them. What is a biocrust? Well, it's the top crunchy layer of soil, seen mostly in arid environments, which homes symbiotic microbes that helps plants to gain nutrients, resist temperature fluctuations, and prevent soil erosion. In other words, biocrust is handy, handy stuff. Southern Cross University's Jeremy Bradley says, at the moment, people don't have a great understanding on what biocrust is and why it's important, and he'd love to see more people working hard to protect it.
Well, first thing you have to do is actually understand that it's there, and then work out strategies on your particular piece of land that you're managing to preserve it. And keeping traffic off it is a good way, or minimising traffic on it is a good way to start. Keep your vehicles on the fence lines or on roads. Make sure, and if you're managing an area that tourists are travelling through, an awareness campaign would be a fantastic thing for those desert national parks and reserves. An awareness of to the tourists that there is a need to stay on the tracks, not just because you're fun police and you don't want them to rev their flashy new four-wheel drives up and down the sand dunes, but there is an actual hard reason that they should stay on the tracks.
So for people to be able to identify that biocrust, it's mostly at the moment a visual inspection. There's not a test that can be done?
A visual inspection on a lot of the areas, especially the low-lying areas, you'll see a black skin on the surface of the soil. That's a more established biocrust, and it contains a lot of melanized organisms, which means that the UV radiation doesn't penetrate very far into the soil, and the other soil organisms can come up closer to the surface and maintain their activities of soil building and stabilization very close to the surface. If there was no melanised biocrust there, then those organisms that are responsible for the production and the maintenance of that soil either would die out or would have to be further down into the soil.
A lot of the NT land is used for grazing land. Is there a balance? How can producers of beef balance good, healthy soil with running cattle?
Okay, and we can do that, of course, because we don't want to eliminate grazing from any of these lands, because grazing is a part of the maintenance of not only our economy but of the soil itself. Because if you didn't graze the land and you didn't manage it at all that biocrust would just fry off in hot fires. And there's good research to say that cool burns are a way of enhancing the biocrust or maintaining the biocrust. Rotational grazing, somehow giving your paddocks a spell. Conservative grazing. Don't push too far into a drought before adjusting your stocking levels. Stocking conservatively is a good way to do it. Get in the top end, especially turn off the vast bulk of your cattle in the dry season and in the wet season. Sorry. And pull back your breeding herds into easily managed paddocks and spell everything else. It's giving the land that little bit of time to rest and recuperate is a good way.
That's Jeremy Bradley, a senior lecturer in regenerative agriculture. He's a farmer himself, speaking there to Victoria Ellis. Tori also caught up with Kathy Eggett, who farms west of Port Macquarie in New South Wales. She's seen major improvements to her soil health through rotational grazing and reckons territory producers could also improve their soil with similar practices.
We've increased our soil organic carbon content by 45% in 10 years, and we can take that further. But what that means to us particularly is our roots can grow deeper, our plants have access to more nutrients, and they can grow better, and the whole system just kicks on and, you know, things improve all by themselves. So the system's a lot more resilient to these extreme events. Like our soil, because of the broken down organic material in it, the humus in that soil, that buffers the pH of the soil. So that helps to make more nutrients available. And also what it does is it has what's known as a cation exchange capacity. It's a very high cation exchange capacity, so it enables those nutrients, really important plant growth nutrients, to be both available to the plants and stored in that topsoil. But a really key thing here is that having all that organic material in the soil stores moisture. So we, like during what we called a drought down in New South Wales, we were able to store 20% more soil moisture in our soil. And that made all the difference. Like that enabled us to grow plants. And then, you know, as the plants became a bit taller, like they were capable of actually catching any dew that came by. And, you know, that would trickle down to the root of the plant, and then the plant would grow better. It's just that the whole system is in a much healthier state and more capable of holding up to these extreme events that we've been experiencing, and we know that we're going to be experiencing more and more often, and the events will be more extreme.
What lessons do you think producers or land managers in the Northern Territory can take from your example, considering that there is, you know, very different amounts of rainfall and very different types of land?
Yeah, absolutely different. I think the grazing management is really important. You know, we need to not push our pastures and our soils too hard. But the key thing really is to improve the health of your soil. Get those organisms happening in there, like, you know, protect your soil crust and, you know, allow the moisture to get into your soil and allow the nutrients to cycle in there. It's the building up the life in the soil. Regenerating the life in the soil is going to help the soil to be and the vegetation to be more resilient to climate change.
That is farmer Kathy Eggert talking dirt with Victoria Ellis.
Hi, Cole Stanton, your local dirt doctor or soil doctor, carrying out some erosion control works on Undrill Your Station at this given moment. And guess what? You're listening to Country Hour.
Just quickly to some resources news. A gas company that's operating in the Beetaloo Basin has just raised nearly $50 million. And a big chunk of that money has come from a US billionaire. I'm joined in the studio by Dan Fitzgerald. Empire Energy is in the money. What can you tell us?
Yeah, Empire Energy has raised $46.8 million, which it'll use to fund more drilling and its pilot gas production in the Beetaloo Basin. So US billionaire Brian Sheffield and his company Liberty Energy have invested about $15 million. Mm-hmm. Brian Sheffield's been a big backer of the US shale gas sector, and he's also pumped a lot of money into the other player in the Beetaloo Basin, Tamboran Resources. So now putting money into Empire Energy. Mm. So Empire says this allows it to drill a 3-kilometre pilot development well and to further progress its Carpentaria pilot project, which it says will aim for commercial production and gas sales next year. Empire Energy Managing Director said Liberty Energy, Brian Sheffield's company, is one of the largest providers of hydraulic fracture stimulation services in the US shale market, and they will soon be sending fracking equipment to Australia to service the nascent Beetaloo Basin. Empire Energy has also sold all of its US oil and gas assets for about $9 million US, making the Beetaloo its only project.
Right, the Beetaloo is its focus as we go to where this afternoon shares in Empire Energy Group down by 2.7%. Thanks for keeping us up to date, Dan. Let's have a quick little tune. And then, as promised, you get to meet this bloke who has paddled down a river in a giant pumpkin. Across the territory on the ABC, you are tuned into the Country Hour. And if you're a long-time listener, you will know that we just love a giant pumpkin story. It's the stuff that gets us out of bed. We love it. And now, very own Dan Fitzgerald, he once grew a giant pumpkin for the Catherine Show. He came third. He's got the ribbon up in his house. And ever since that, he has kept a very close eye on all giant pumpkin news. And Dan, this story, I mean, it's more than just growing a giant pumpkin, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a bit going on here, Matt. So a New South Wales man, Mark Peacock, he grew a 407-kilogram giant pumpkin. It won the blue ribbon recently at the Royal Easter Show in Sydney, which is a great effort.
You'd be happy with that.
Yeah, but what happened next? Well, it might be even better. Mark Peacock, he gave this massive pumpkin to his mate, Adam Farkhuizen, who hollowed out the giant pumpkin and then paddled it down the Tumut River in the snowy mountains. I've seen some of the vision. He's wearing a little sailor's hat while he's doing it.
Inspired by Popeye, I think,
yeah,
I saw.
Yeah, had an old-fashioned pipe in his mouth, and he looks like he's just having a blast doing it. Apparently up to 1,000 people may have lined the banks watching him do this. People were chasing him down the river. And Adam Farkhuizen, he told Eliza Getzy about his adventure in this pumpkin.
I called it Cinderella because every boat should have a name. Before that, it was called Tormund, which is from a Game of Thrones character. So that was named by the man who actually grew it. So many, many years ago, about 14, 15 years ago, I tried to grow a giant pumpkin in a competition with some mates and failed terribly. Mine got to about the size of a grapefruit, shriveled and died. So I did actually plan. My plan was to paddle it down the river, but that wasn't going to happen. When Mark grew this one, I did see it and asked him what he was going to do with it. And when I told him I wanted to paddle it, he thought that was a top idea. But it was 407 kilos when he took it up to the Sydney show.
Adam, how do you carve out a 407-kilo pumpkin? That sounds like a big job.
It is. I didn't actually do that. So Mark and his dad carved it out to get the seeds out of it. So the seeds for that, he reckons, are about $50 each. So That was his job. He wanted to retain the seeds. I don't know whether he thought I was going to nick them or not. But, yeah, so essentially the only thing I did with that pumpkin apart from paddle it was draw Cinderella on the side with a texter. So, yeah, I didn't have to do much at all.
What a beautiful vessel it sounds like. So, and like you say, you've tried to pull this off before and failed. Tell me how she went this time.
Well, if I had tried to paddle my tiny dead pumpkin down the river, I would have drowned. Yeah, it went really well. The night before, I was moderately concerned it wasn't going to float. Once I actually got out in the river, I knew it was a floaty thing. So it's sort of like a closed foam rubber, I think, they're quite buoyant. Yeah, it was just a matter of controlling it, which was, yeah, I suppose it sat very deep in the water, especially because it was heavy and so am I. And just, yeah, thinking ahead and planning where I was going to be on the river. But it was, yeah, really good. It was a lot of fun. I must say, I've never had that much fun going down a river before.
Did you have an audience?
Yeah, I did. On Friday before I did it, my wife said, oh, you probably should put it on Facebook. And we watched a movie with the kids, and then I got Facebook on and I had hundreds of likes, and I thought, oh, this has got pretty escalated. It was like an Anchorman sort of a moment. And, yeah, I think Mark, I didn't actually look at the crowd, but Mark reckons he reckons about 1,000. So if that's the case, that's pretty impressive. What I saw was people running down the bank trying to keep up with me because the river's pretty fast and I'm just bobbing along in a huge gourd.
Wow. So I was going to say, what is the Tumut River like? I imagine it's probably still a bit chilly at this time of year too, is it?
Yeah, it's always cold. It comes out of the bottom of a blowing dam, so right at the base of the Snowy Hydro Scheme, so it's always chilly. Yeah, it's a cold river. It's very clean and quite fast. So, yeah, I've spent a lot of time in the canoe club here, so I've paddled that river hundreds of times. I wouldn't certainly recommend going down in a pumpkin if you don't know what you're doing. But yeah, it's a beautiful river. It's really pretty. So I love it.
Fantastic. So it's fair to say you're probably the first person to ride in a pumpkin down the Tumut River.
I'm pretty confident. Yeah, I don't think it's a niche market. I don't think many people have done it before. I don't think anybody's done it before, actually.
So how far did you go and how long did that take?
It was 1.6K, so a mile if you're talking black and white. And I think it took about 20 minutes. It's pretty quick.
Gosh, that is quick. And yeah, I guess you'd want to be certain that the pumpkin was pretty reliable, and it obviously was.
It certainly was, yeah. Once I got out in the current, I knew it was going to be fine, but the bottom of the pumpkin was probably, I suppose in old speak, about 6 to 8 inches thick, and then it tapered. The top of it was about 2.5 inches, so it was pretty big. It was a unit, that's for sure.
And what happens to the pumpkin now?
Well, sadly, because it was 350 kilos when I got hold of it, we got it in the river by pulling it off the back of a trailer on a pallet and just bobbed it into the river. Once we finished, there was no way to get it out of there without some sort of lifting apparatus. So we, yeah, essentially chopped it up with an axe and put it on a trailer, and now it's feeding my in-laws' cattle out on their farm.
That is Adam Farquharson speaking to Eliza Getzey. What a story. What a man. What a pumpkin. Just quickly, in case you missed our chat with the Weather Bureau, Billy Lynch today mentioned the C word and how there is something stirring in our northern waters.
So what we're expecting is we could get a low pressure system form over the next day or two, somewhere between the northeast Arnhem District and North Queensland. And then, yeah, look, if things are going well for it from a cyclone perspective, there is just a window over the weekend, Saturday, Sunday, where we could get a small tropical cyclone up in the Arafura Sea. So we're just trying to highlight that risk. So it's about a 25% risk that we've got, a moderate risk over the weekend.
A moderate risk of a small tropical cyclone. We will wait to see. That's it for today's Country Hour. Keep it rural.